one time, they found a river basin that was good, where the soil looked like it was good for the corn, beans, and squash. And it looked like they had a clean source of water. And so what they did, they moved there and they lived their life, and they planted their gardens. But what they found out when, after the thaw came, they couldn't depend on where the river and the water would flow. And so what happened was, every time they would move to a place in this river basin and the thaws would come, the river would almost always find its way and go right through the village. And so for a season, the people were trying to figure out how do we keep the water from coming through our village? How do we keep the water from just rolling through our garden? And sure enough, every time those thaws came, the water, even though they would change the location of their village or their garden, every time those thaws came, it was like the water was seeking them out. And the water was always coming down and washing them right out. And it was frustrating. It was a time of frustration because people were trying all kinds of ways to think how they could control the water, how they could protect what they were planting, how they could protect where they're living. And, you know, the elders were turning their thinking over. Everybody was turning their thinking over. How can we control this water? How can we control this? And every season, that thaw would come, and it would wash everything out no matter what they did. And finally, it was an elder who came and says, you know, you're thinking of it in a backward way. And everybody sat and listened to it. And he said, what you need to do, he said, next time the thaw comes and the water comes, he goes, instead of worrying about where the water goes and how to control it, he said, follow that water back. Follow where it came from and go back to the high places where the sources, and keep following that water higher and higher until that water becomes a stream, then it becomes a little creek, and you'll see where the source of that water comes from. And he said, then what you do, you bend down and you pick up a little pebble, and you put that pebble in the stream, and you'll change the course of the river just by going up to the source and putting a pebble in the water, putting a pebble in the stream. And I really believe that what we're doing here today, bringing our hearts and our minds together today about Mother Earth and the water, is that we are, in essence, trying to put or become those pebbles in the stream. Pebbles in the stream of thinking, pebbles in the stream of changing the ways that we're doing things and looking at how we can do it, how we can stay, not just for ourselves, but for our families and for future generations.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you. Before I go any further, I want to acknowledge the ancestors who lived here, who traveled here, who made their home here, who commuted through here, traveled and walked. And so I just wanted to make mention of those ancestors. Of course, the Mishkwaki and the Sakapaks, the Weas, Odawa, Ojibwe, Chippewa, Anishinaabe, Kickapoos, Wyan, Ottawas, Potawatomis, Shawnees, Senecas, Muscutans, Menominees, Miamis, Cherokees, Wyandots, Winnebagoes, Oto, Kansa, the Omaha, and that's just to name a few, you know, who have made their footprints, took those steps through this area. So I just wanted to acknowledge those ancestors and thank them for guiding us, for being here, and for also handing down the traditions and the ceremonies and the language and the foods and the harvesting and all that knowledge that they have learned from their ancestors. And so we want to continue that in a good way. Again, my name is Regina Sosi. I am president of the Native American Coalition of the Quad Cities, and also a co-founder of the Sage Sisters of Solidarity. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Native American Coalition here, what we've been doing, what's going on, a little bit about the urban population here. Of course, how many people arrived here as far as indigenous peoples from the reservations is probably through the Relocation Act in the 1950s. And so, through that movement and through the choice of those individuals, they would come into the big urban areas. City, Chicago, all these different areas that were hugely populated in urban areas. And so they were asked, they were also provided, you know, just different funding and things like that, because they took them off those reservations, and they, these people moved into an area that we had no idea, you know, paying real estate taxes, insurance, trying to find homes and things of that nature. So they were provided different provisions, you know, as far as funding, medical health, clinics were set up. And so that's how a lot of people lived in that way. So when I first arrived here in 1983, I found out that it was hard to connect with indigenous people, because at that time there was hardly any people, or I did not know. And of course, being the Navajo, raised in the West, and then coming to the Midwest area, it was kind of a whole new environment for me. So I first immediately was in Indian people, tried to seek out other Indian people, you know, go to the grocery store, the laundromat, or out in the streets, and or churches, you know. And then you see someone, oh, that might be somebody indigenous over there, and see if they are. So you go over, you know, and you say hi, you greet yourself, or greet them, and introduce yourself, and ask, by the way, do you happen to be Native American or indigenous? And sometimes they say yes, sometimes they don't know what we're talking about. So when they say yes, we go, oh my goodness, wonderful. It's good to see another Native person in the area. That's how I learned to come into the Native American community here. In 84, there was not very many. I think there was a coalition of organized urban Indians in the area. There was an urban Indian tribal league that was, like, again, formed in the 50s, and then they were pretty active until the early 70s. And then they disbanded. When I came in, there was no activity. A year and a half later, I noticed in the newspaper that there was a story about, this Lakota man was wanting to start an organization. And there was going to be a meeting somewhere in this area. So that was publicized, and I went to that meeting. Gosh darn it, there were about maybe 30 other Native peoples there, you know, lived in Moline, Rock Island, Davenport, Bettendorf, all over the Quad Cities. So it was really good to connect with them. And then from there, we've got Quad City League of Native Americans was created in the mid-80s to 2000, and then that got disbanded. And then another organization was created, and of course, you know, you get the same people, but maybe new faces. That disbanded, and then later on, the Native American Coalition of the Quad Cities was created in 2006. And again, you know, Native peoples, families who were interested would come together then. Again, new faces, a lot of indigenous families did not stay in the area. And so, you know, just a mixture, but sometimes you get, you know, the familiar faces here gathered together. So we formed in 2006, and pretty active in a lot of activities during that time here in the state of Illinois. One of those things was the mascot issue, the University of Illinois, Champaign Urbana over at Chico Illinois. And I think Chicago people also were involved in that too. It got to the point, and well, it was brought to the our attention, and the movement, I believe, started with a young indigenous woman, Charlene Teeters, Spokane, very great woman, very talented and outspoken, and she did it because of her children. She was recruited by the University of Illinois to come and do her graduate work in art. And so they recruited her, she came with her children. And then while the school was starting, and they were really interested in attending a subject sports, you know, university sponsored sports. So our staff football. So somebody sort of tended to attend a game, and so they did. They attended the game, the home game. And when the part where Keefe Alinowit came out and was prancing and doing all these stuff, and the band would play that her children looked really dismayed and really upset, and it upset her too. And so I think that's where that movement came, that that being a mother trying to protect your children, you know, from anything, you know, to be there for them. And so from that time on, she alone would just stand out in these in front of the stadiums with a sign in her hand, and just by herself, "I am not a mascot." You know, that was, she did that for a number of months. And I think the American Indian movement people noticed that, so they came and supported her. And so that's where that big movement came in. That was probably the mid-1990s. And it got to the point where the Senate, the government here, was trying to protect that, and they were going to pass a resolution, a House bill, to protect Keefe Alinowit. And it was just really ridiculous. You know, they're going to protect this imaginary thing, you know, and have a state law. And if you, you know, if that was passed, and you know, we would be prosecuted for, you know, demonstrating. So the government butt heads with the Native peoples in the state. There's support from outside of the state too. And then in 2007, with the movement and how it grew, and a lot of the community members, non-Indigenous community members, churches, other cultural groups, they supported that movement, and then in 2007 the symbol was removed. And then the NCAA came into that and also sanctioned the University of Illinois, stating that if they were invited to any NCAA tournaments, then they could not attend because of, if they still had the mascot. So that also helped too. Currently, I guess the symbol is, they changed it just to the line. There still is a strong group of students there, pro-teachers. I've not heard too much about that, so, but you know, we try to keep our ears open for that. Another issue that we've come across too, as immigrant peoples here, is a protection of sacred sites. That is really a big issue in this area because, of course, you know, in the Squaxis and the Sox, this is our homeland. A lot of bluff areas, there are mountains, along the river areas. And so one instance was back in the late 1990s, the golf course, TPC golf course out in Kelowna. Yes. What's that called? I can't remember the name of it. But people who owned that area and gave it to, or the TPC bought it from them, knew there were mounds there. And that got word to our group, and it got also word to the Meskwakis and Tema, and also another group in Chicago, Midwest Soaring. They were also notified. So we all came together, and we counseled with the developer and the owner of the property out there, and that really ended pretty well. It's groups like that, when they come together and there's not a big scene and try to think, work things in a good way. And I think there's probably about 30 of us that came together and just one area near the property. And but we left it to the Meskwakis because they were the closest relatives to the people in this area.
say, both men are very knowledgeable in the old ways, and so through their guidance and through their counsel, they led the way of our groups who were there to support. And that's what we do when we try to come together. There's an issue when we know that, you know, we're not, you know, I'm Navajo, I'm Southwest, I know quite a bit about that. I come into this area, I don't know that much. And so we try to find people who are connected, who know more knowledge about who are relatives, and we let them lead and we support them in that way. And so that turned out really well. They asked, well, what can we do to protect the mounds? And so they gave their suggestions, and the suggestions were to surround the mounds with natural barricade, natural deterrent, you know, like thorny bushes, things of that nature that are indigenous to this area. And so, and also, they also wanted to stay in communication with any other developments and anything that would happen to the TPC golf course out there. So we were at a powwow last weekend, Midwest Soaring sponsored, I talked to Standing Bear Ranch, who was also involved with this, and I asked him, I said, well, have you heard anything about, you know, the TPC area there? She says, yeah, I got contacted about 2 weeks ago, and they were wondering, you know, who wanted to come out and do it. So that was really good. You know, you get the corporate people inviting us again to come out and see if there's anything that needs to be discussed, you know. And so I said, well, that was really good. So hopefully later on that I would like to contact them and invite any other indigenous peoples, the Sauk or the Squatty to come out too. So we try to work together and things of that nature. Another thing that we've had issues with too in the past, but not as much pop out up now, is plastic medicine people, you know, the shamans, plastic shamans. And and at that time, it was pretty publicized when the, I can't think of that man's name that had that sweat lodge that burnt down. Anyway, but during that time too, when there were some just very few people in the area who were coming into the area proclaiming that they were knowledgeable in the native ways, and no, I guess which is fine, you know. But then if they start charging, and you know, and they start trying to sell their books or, you know, or their healing ways, you know, then it really brings out the exploitation of our sacred ways, and we, as indigenous people, feel that, you know, that's just another way of stealing. So we make come together and we figure out, well, okay, how can we fight against this? We first thing we like to do is just talk to the people, you know, face to face, and find out where they're coming from. If that doesn't work, then we go just go out to the streets and start protesting. And sometimes we've been kicked out of places, you know, police have been coming to the site where we were protesting and taking down names and telling us to leave, so it's gotten that far. So some are probably on the hit list somewhere. But I guess the main point is, and I know we have another time on the air, is that as indigenous people, and we work together, we encourage non-native peoples to come and learn from us, to support us, and that's what our coalition does. We do encourage non-native peoples to support us, to join us, to be part of our group, and to stand up with us too. Also with our coalition, we are many tribes, so so we exchange our cultural knowledge. Like I said earlier, I don't know the ways in the Squawky, their crafts, or beadwork, band making, regalia, things of that nature. So we talk, we share, we teach, and we come together. We try to provide a meal too, because that's a good way to come together as family. And being away from my family in Arizona, the indigenous people in this community is my second family. And it's really, there's a close-knit type feeling that we have here. In fact, this is our home here, because we meet here every fourth Thursday of the month in this area, singing. We have a good relationship with Black Hawk State Historic Site. They're really good people. They are respectful of the ways. Anytime we need this facility, and if it's not booked, then they offer to us. They charge people, but knowing that our group is indigenous, they feel that we're not going to charge you for your own land. And so that is really good that they think in that way. There are other groups that now have been supporting us as far as, you know, with our social issues, MMIW, and Josie here? Just not. But that will be, I can talk about that after the next presentation, and how that is. I just want to say thank you very much for giving me this time, and if you have any other questions, you know, talk to me from later on.
Thank you so much, Regina. Thank you, everybody. I'm able to have questions and open discussion with everyone at the end, if that's okay. So I wanted to invite now, and maybe can I introduce you all a little bit? Nation Food Council are here today. I'm super excited about this. I met these folks about 6 years ago. Somebody told me in Chicago that there was some Native youth who were going out and tapping maples in their neighborhood in the public way. And I thought, well, that sounds really cool. You know, what did I know? Some kids doing cultural stuff, you know? I'm going to go. And so a bunch of us went, I think about 20 people from this kind of No Border Autonomous Collective movements went, and did not expect